Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to Nomads Past and Present, a podcast about nomadism and nomadic peoples around the world and throughout history. I'm your host, Maggie Freeman, and my guest today is Dr. Charlotte Markina. Charlotte is a social anthropologist and associate professor in Mongolian language and culture at the National Institute for Oriental Languages and Civilizations in Paris. Her research focuses on human-animal coexistence, communication, and collaborations in nomadic pastoralist communities in Mongolia and southern Siberia. Her book, which is titled Nomadic Pastoralism Among the Mongol Herders, Multispecies and Spatial Ethnography in Mongolia and Transbaikalia, was published in 2021 by Amsterdam University Press, and that's what we'll be talking about today. So thank you so much, Charlotte, for joining me.
Thank you so much for inviting me today.
So to get started, so your research, or the research that's presented in your book, focuses on nomadic pastoralist communities in what are today two different countries. So you're working on pastoralists in Mongolia and also in Buryatia, which is a Russian province that borders northern Mongolia. So can you talk a little bit about sort of those two communities? What are the sort of differences or similarities between them? And why did you decide to conduct this kind of multi-country research as opposed to just focusing on one national context or the other?
So maybe the easiest is to explain how I came to work on Siberia, because I started actually to work on Mongolia while I was a master's student. I studied the human-horse relationship among the herders of Mongolia. And I started with studies in anthropology and studies in Mongolian language and culture. And I actually studied before Russian language already in high school, and very few Mongolists in Europe speak both Mongolian and Russian. And so I was wisely advised to compare the situation between two Mongolic ethnic groups on both sides of the Mongolia-Russia border, as I was already a Russian speaker. So the second year of my master's program, I extended my research also to the Buryats. So the Buryats, they are a Mongol ethnic group. They live mostly in Russia. They are the northernmost Mongol ethnic group, but there are also Buryats in Mongolia and in Inner Mongolia in China, which makes the situation quite complicated, but they mostly live in Russia, and in Mongolia there are also several ethnic groups, but I focused my research on the Half Mongolians, which are the majority ethnic group in Mongolia. And so I was very interested in comparing the situation, as the Mongols and the Buryats, they are both Mongol-speaking groups. They both practice nomadic, extensive pastoralism, but they live in very different economical, political contexts. And I was very interested in the influence of Russian culture and Russian context on the Buryat culture and their relations to animals and husbandry, relations to the environment. And I decided also to focus on the most eastern Buryats of Russia, because traditionally we can distinguish between the western Buryats, located west of the Lake Baikal, who traditionally live in a forest environment and traditionally live more from hunting practices than husbandry. And while the eastern Buryats, that is in Transbaikalia, they practice a very extensive husbandry, nomadic husbandry, which is closer to the Mongolian way of living. And so actually I conducted fieldwork outside of the Republic of Buryatia, because in Russia, the Buryats, they live mainly in the Republic of Buryatia, but also in two distinct Buryats districts in east and west of the Republic of Buryatia. And so I conducted fieldwork in the most eastern district, which is the Aga district, and which is today located in the Transbaikalia region.
And so throughout your book, you use the terms nomadizing and nomadization. Can you explain those a little bit? You know, how are you understanding those terms, and why do you use those terms quite explicitly? You know, I think you use them quite intentionally, as opposed to terms we're maybe more familiar with or maybe more customary, like nomad, nomadic, nomadism. How are you kind of splitting the hairs there?
Actually, that's a question, I think, of translation. French, as this book was translated from French. I originally wrote this book in French, and it was published in 2019. And in French, we make this distinction between migrating and nomadizing, as migrating is seen as a permanent movement with a permanent change. A definite change of location, whereas nomadizing is, which is actually also translated in English as migrating. But it implies that the movements are cyclical, and you come each year to the same places again. So maybe, yeah, with now that I have also some feedback on the book, maybe I would now actually translate it into English as like migrating instead of nomadizing. And so yeah, what I call in the book nomadization is to be understood as a migration, like a nomadic migration.
And how did the communities that you worked among, how did they define themselves and their lifestyles? Would they have defined it in kind of similar terms? Or what are, you know, I understand that obviously they would use terms from other languages, but how would you translate how they defined their lifestyles and their kind of nomadic, nomadizing practices?
So in Mongolia, so just also to give some elements of context for people who don't know anything about Mongolian culture and Mongolian husbandry, Mongolian pastoralists, they move several times a year. Depends on the region, depends on the size of their herds, depends on their personal history. But they move between, well, they say traditionally four times a year each season, but some move only twice a year, and some also will move up to 15, 20 times in a year, depending on their environment and other factors. They don't define themselves as nomads, because they define themselves just as herders. Because traditionally in Mongolia, all herders are nomads. So there is no need to specify that they are nomads. But they have this verb nuh, which means like to migrate, to move places. When I started to do research about the Buryats of Russia, there was very few literature available about the AGA Buryats, the Buryats where I with whom I conducted field work, and they were only mainly work about their traditional way of life at the early 20th century, and those works mostly described their way of life, which seemed very, very close to the way of life of the Mongols of Mongolia. And so when I arrived for the first time in that region, I was expecting yurts. I was expecting, so because the Mongols, they live in yurts, it's like circular tent made of felt and wood. And but everybody was very surprised that I was looking for nomads living in yurts. So I met herders living in wooden houses, and they were very surprised that I could compare their situation to that of the Mongol herders of Mongolia. And so, but when I asked them if they were still if they weren't nomads, say no, we're not nomads. You know, nomads you have in northern Siberia with reindeer. We're not nomads. And then, maybe a few hours later, some herder mentioned that they were about to migrate to nomadize to the next for the next season. And so I asked them, but won't you be migrating or nomadizing? You just told me you're not a nomad. And said, yeah, of course we nomadize or we migrate. So they used the term in Buryat, which is very close to the Mongolian one, but also in Russian, the term that is used to say to be nomad. And so they also didn't define themselves as nomads, but they were moving seasonally for their herds. But one of the main differences is that they live now in wooden houses and not in yurts anymore, and which makes flexibility quite difficult in comparison with the Mongolian situation in case of climatic disaster, drought, or or a harsh winter. They don't have the possibility of changing their route or in itinerary, which is quite different from Mongolia.
And so what factors led to the use of wooden houses in Buryatia then, if it generates conditions of less flexibility, what led to that shift?
Of course, the influence of Russian culture is important in that region. The Buryats started to be in very close contact with Russian culture from the 17th, 18th century. And so it first had an impact on the practices of husbandry, of agriculture. They started to grow vegetables, also to grow more and more crop, and also to live in wooden houses, which were deemed more comfortable than yurts. They like to have they have like a very more Russianized way of life with small wooden houses that are used to bath. Like it's a bit like it's a banya in Russian. It's like a little sauna, they have also their vegetable plot now. Even if they're herders, pastoralists, they now have access to electricity. And also they state themselves that they don't like to go to their summer station because the Buryats nowadays have two farms or stations, and the summer station is located usually on the hills and are further away from the village. They don't have access to electricity at the difference of the main or the main station, which is used from autumn to spring.
And what are the land policies in these respective regions? You know, how is herders' access to land governed? By what institutions? Is it collectively owned? Is it managed through herding associations? Is it owned by the government? Is it leased? What does that look like in the two different countries? Because I imagine there are quite different kind of structural forces at play.
Yes, the situation is quite different. In Mongolia, land at the countryside, it's very different situation in the cities. But in the countryside, land is either publicly owned or owned by say associations of herders, and they then have contracts in which they explain how and when herders use the land. But there is no, what is important is that there's no individual private property on the land among the herders, which is very important to maintain a level of flexibility in case of climatic irregularity. So this does not mean that there are not uses of land that define who uses which places, which land. So the herders have a kind of fixed winter and or spring encampment, so they know and the state knows exactly where the herders live, where they spend the winter, when they spend a spring, and that is their official place of where the place where they live. But there is some flexibility with the summer encampments, which can change from year to year if there are if there is any difficulty or climate change, for example. In Russia, the situation is quite different because after the fall of the Soviet system, land was, well, the government encouraged land privatization. What happened is that, so the animals were privatized, which was also the case, by the way, in Mongolia after the fall of the socialist regime. But in Russia, documents were distributed to encourage land privatization, and in particular in this in the Buryat regions in 1995. But they the herders actually saw no interest in privatizing the land, because the uses of land just stayed the same. So they would just continue to use land as they did before. And they, what they saw in this privatization was only additional costs, maybe taxes, and also the loss of flexibility and maybe even more common use, because herders, they share pastures. For example, cows can graze, of different herders can graze together on the same land. So they didn't do anything with those documents, but then in 2011 and 12, the Russian government stated that if they didn't do anything with those rights, land could actually go back to the state, and then if it wasn't privatized, herders. They were actually afraid that they could be kicked out of their land. So they were kind of forced into land privatization. So herders became slowly, officially owners of their lands. But during the first year, it actually didn't change that much, as they continued to use the land as they did before. Some herders use this opportunity to start growing more crop and also to fence the land. So this might, I hope to go back to the field in the coming years. I don't know when, because of course it's very complicated now, and to see how the situation is going to evolve, because we know that this fencing of the land also happened in Inner Mongolia and China, and that this led to ecological disaster because of this lack of flexibility and common use of pastures.
Mm-hmm. And so since you brought up livestock, we should probably talk about animals, since your research is on human-animal relations and collaboration. So just sort of the basics for somebody who is not familiar with this context, what is the livestock that's owned and herded by Mongolians and Buryats? You know, you've already mentioned cows, I think, but there are certainly other animals that are herded. So what are those?
So traditionally, the Mongol peoples, they raise what they call the five muzzles. And the five muzzles are horses, camels, cattle. So cattle includes cows, but also yaks and hybrids of those, sheep and goats. So nowadays in among the Buryats, the camels are almost gone. Their number declined during the 20th century, during the Soviet period, as they were mainly used in the Mongolian way of life for transport and for to migrate and as a labor force. And slowly, as husbandry was mechanized, there wasn't much need anymore. And so they are nowadays, there may be like 20 camels in the Buryat region, which are kept for symbolic reasons, because the Buryats, they traditionally raise the five muzzles, so it's good to keep them for symbolic reasons, but they don't do anything with them. They don't eat the meat, they don't milk them, they don't use their wool. So they actually only now mainly raise horses, cows, sheep and goats, and also pigs, which is also which were introduced in the 20th century and under Russian influence. In Mongolia, they raise the five muzzles, not all the five in all regions, also depending on climatic and environmental conditions, but they eat the meat of all those animals, they milk them all, they use the wool or the hair of all those animals, they use horses and camels as mounts. They use camels as pack animals. They use camels and yaks as draft animals.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And something I found fascinating in your book was your discussion of the kind of the knowledge of the landscape, of the availability of natural resources, of migratory routes that these animals possess. And I found that just a really interesting way of, I think, illuminating the different factors that inform pastoralism and sort of pastoralist practices and knowledge, that it's not just kind of human informed and human driven, but that there's also this animal knowledge that plays such a huge role. So could you talk about that a little bit more, about sort of, I guess, how you kind of observe that animal knowledge of their surroundings and of the landscape, what that looks like in practice?
Yes, so maybe I have to talk a bit about how I came to work on this human-animal relations and what I was interested in and at the beginning of my research. So I, during my master's degree, I worked on human-horse relationship, and especially on how the agency of the horse plays a role in their own husbandry, and how horses are kind of considered of agents of their own husbandry. So I looked at how herders distinguish between their different animals at the inside the herd, how they give different roles to the different animals depending on their individualities, their age, their physical characteristics, and their psychology, and so my question was really, how do herders rely on the agency of their animals in their husbandry system? And I was interested in way herders and animals coexist, how they communicate, and how they collaborate in daily pastoral tasks. And of course, the first questions I dealt with in the field was, how do they concretely live on the steppe in this landscape? As for example, you don't see any fences, you can't. If you don't stay a year with them, or if you don't track their movements, it's difficult to see how they move in the landscape. What is their territory, migratory territory? What is their route? And also, how do they share this land with other herders, neighboring herders? How do they use this space? So I wanted to understand how the space is used. So I started, as I said, herders have, they raise the five muzzles. This implies that they have different herds depending on the species, that they have at least four different herds, and usually more. And so I started to track the animals' movements with GPS, and to map daily routes, and also to map seasonal movements. And so, of course, as there aren't as many herders as there are animals, the animals need to be relatively autonomous in their movements. They need to know, of course, they know the places, as they also come. As their movements are cyclical, they come every year to the same places, the same pastures. The animals know the landscape as the humans do. So I was interested in which species uses which part of the land, how they learn, what are the limits of the land they are supposed to use, as lands, of course, is shared with neighboring herders. Their herders also need to be careful that their different herds don't mix with each other, for example. And so mapping those movements was one way of understanding how the animals' movements are controlled, more or less, depending on the species, and also on their use and what frequency. For example, the sheep and the goats, which graze together in the same herd, they can be watched for the whole day continuously, depending on the environment and depending on neighboring flocks. Whereas horses and camels can graze autonomously for several days or even sometimes several weeks. And the herders rely on the knowledge and on the autonomy of the animals to come back to the encampment, for example. The cows, they know that they need to be milked in the evening, so they usually come back by themselves in the evening. Also, of course, because they're calves, they stay on the encampment, which plays an attractive role in this system. And I was very interested also in what herders say about the knowledge of the animals of the landscape. So the Mongols, they have this this concept of nutek, which means literally homeland. But which also, this notion of homeland also encompasses the relations herders have with other people living on the same in the same place, but also a relationship with invisible entities. And the animals, they know very well also their nutek. They know where their homeland is, and this is made very visible when an animal is sold to another herder, for example. Where herders always have problems with their new horses running back to their former owner and former nutek, former homeland.
And so, since you brought up the issue of pastoralist relationships with other people in the same landscape, I was hoping you could talk a little bit more about what those relationships are like, and specifically pastoralist relationships with non-pastoralists, with agriculturalists, or with other kind of non-herding communities, because this seemed like a kind of recurring issue throughout your research of these kind of, maybe conflicts is too strong a word, but just the tensions that can arise between people who are herding livestock and people who are not. So could you talk about that a little bit?
So in Mongolia, where I did field work, these were regions where there were almost only herders. So if there are any difficulties with neighbors, then it's with other herders. And the main issues are the mixing of flocks, sheep and goats, but also with environmental change and the disappearance of some rivers and lakes. This means that there are less water points available, also less pasture lands that can be used, and that herders are forced to graze on smaller areas and closer to each other. So this can be sometimes in some years, depending on the climate, this can be a very difficult issue. In among the Buryats in Russia, the situation is quite different, as they practice much more agriculture. Not so much the herders themselves, but there are some agriculturalists, but and also cooperatives, as herders are often members of cooperatives, which are a legacy of the Soviet system, collective system. So actually at the fall of the USSR, the collective farms, kolkhoz, they were they disappeared, but in reality not so much, as they were replaced by cooperative farms, and people still call them kolkhoz. So in those cooperatives, they practice, they cultivate lands, to sell crops or to distribute crops to the herders, as during the 20th century, under the influence of Russian productivism in the agricultural in agricultural activities, new races of animal and animal Western types of animal were imported, which needed much more. They needed crop and hay, and so there is the need for agriculture is much more important. So the cooperative have huge surfaces of cultivated lands, which of course creates tensions with the herders living in the area. Because of those cultivated lands, the herders, they really need to move places when comes the time of the when the growing, I don't know how you call it, the growing season is, let's speak. Herders, they tend to move less because also of those, I talked about it, about the lack of electricity under a summer station. They now prefer to watch TV, which is not possible on the summer station. And some herders stopped to move places, and which of course creates huge tensions with those cultivated lands. And it's also not always possible to fence those areas because these are really huge areas they need to fence. And traditionally they didn't need to fence them as herders would move during during the summer. But the lack also of fences leads to tensions as animals, they go on those cultivated lands, and of course is causing huge damages to those cultivated lands.
Mm. And so just to continue off of what you just said about, you know, herders preferring to stay in areas with electricity that are sort of more comfortable, I found really interesting some of these examples throughout your book of the people that you interviewed saying, at least this is how it was translated in the English version, saying that they're sort of getting lazy in terms of how they prefer some of the kind of more modern equipment and technology, access to electricity, migrating using trucks instead of livestock. There was one example I found really interesting of, I think it was a herding pastoralist woman you interviewed who said that she liked living in a wooden house with windows because she could watch her livestock from inside the house through the windows using binoculars and didn't have to go outside. And so all of these kind of introductions of kind of modern life, I guess, into this environment and this context, but that there is a kind of sense of guilt among people when they adopt these modern instruments, that they're sort of relinquishing something, that they're giving something up, that they're kind of not doing nomadism in the right way or in kind of the traditional way. I found that really interesting. And I was wondering how kind of widespread that is, if you found that to be kind of a common sentiment that people express the adoption of kind of modern technology and equipment as kind of laziness, or is it also kind of balanced with this sense of practicality?
Actually, I think it's not the use of technology that is perceived as associated with guilt. When we look at the situation in Mongolia, almost all herders now have smartphones. They all watch TV. They all have solar panel, which they use to recharge their phones and watch TV. But they still continue to live under the yurt, and they use all this technology in their pastoral practices. They use phones to call a neighbor to ask whether he has seen his camels, or they use Facebook to sell animals or to buy animals. So it's really this is really widespreadly used in Mongolia. In Siberia, the situation is quite different because people slowly stopped to move places, and this is what is associated with guilt. They know they should be move for the summer, but also to spare the lands, to protect the cultivated lands, and they stop doing it because they call themselves they say that they are lazy because they said. It's easier to move when someone is forced to move, and the cooperative should encourage people to move. But as the cooperatives are slowly starting to disappear, they don't move anymore. And I think this also the role also of Russian and urban environment is very very important among the Buryats. I was really struck by the fact that herders themselves, some told me they actually drink, when they want to drink milk, they sometimes buy milk from a store and don't drink the milk of their own animals, as they started to find that the smell is very strong. So, I have the impression they more and more want to live in, as you taught, in wooden houses, but it is also in spaces which are clearly separated, which create a clear separation with the animal, with the animals. So, at the difference of the yurt, the felt yurt, from which you hear every sound of the animals at night. You can check whether everyone is okay just by listening to the sounds of the herds. The situation in among the Buryats, once you've closed the door of the house, you don't hear anything. But you could look at your herd from the window, in fact, and you can also call your neighbor to check on your herds through him.
And so maybe a final question, as we're coming up on the end of our time. I'm curious about sort of, you mentioned this a little bit earlier about the potential of future research in this context, especially in Buryatia, which is complicated, obviously, by the war in Ukraine. So I'm just wondering, you know, what your future plans for research are in light of this, and also if you have a sense of how this place and this community are affected by the war. I think we get a lot of news, at least where I am, about the sort of disproportionate conscription of ethnic minorities, especially those from Siberia, into the Russian army. So I'm just wondering, you know, from your position, having, I think, much closer knowledge of this context than I do, probably than most Western journalists also, if you have a sense of what that looks like, how the wars is impacting this region, which is so far from Ukraine, but I think from what I've heard has been having kind of a disproportionate effect on that community.
Yes, the Buryats are particularly affected by those conscriptions. Not the people I know. The people I know in cities as well as in the countryside, they just tell me it's difficult because it's economically difficult because everything has become so expensive. And also they can't travel abroad if they need. And a lot of people are fleeing from Russia into Mongolia because the border is still open. But that's actually all I hear about the war from this region. It's more, they had already very difficult economic conditions since 2008, particularly difficult, and it's getting it's just getting worse economically speaking. So about my future plans. Last time I was in Russia was in with the Buryats was in 2016, and I hope to go back in 2020. And then, of course, COVID, I wasn't able to. So my plans are to continue my research in Mongolia and try in the future try to compare the situation of different ethnic groups inside inside Mongolia. I started to do field work among the Kazakhs of the Altai Mountain of Mongolia, and if I have the chance to do that, I would like also to start a new field work with the Duha reindeer herders of northern Mongolia in the taiga. That is inside the same country, compare different ethnic, cultural, and also environmental conditions and the effects of those conditions on human-animal relations in pastoralism.
And so do you think that the ethnic makeup of Mongolia is also going to change a little bit now with, like you said, people fleeing from Russia into Mongolia? Do you think that will have an effect on your future research in Mongolia with kind of displaced people entering the country?
I don't think so, because people are mostly fleeing from urban centers to the capital, and it's also not massive migration. But what happened in Russia, in Buryatia, is and in the Aga district where I work, is Russian. Following difficult economic conditions, is Russian people being employed by Buryat herders as herding assistants, which had, this was a massive phenomenon, which had really important impacts on animal relations, with language changes and also way of interacting with animals in a more Western way in a more Western style. But yes, this is another topic we don't have time to develop.
No, I promise that was my last question. Well, thank you so much for joining me and for sharing your research with us. I think it's really, really interesting, especially how you, kind of tease out and bring nuance to our understanding of especially human-animal relations, human-landscape relations, animal-landscape relations, all of these kind of complex factors that make up pastoralism as a system. So thank you so much for sharing that with us.
Thank you.